Audio hosting for comics are great is provided by Kablam, KABLAM.com, the one-stop printing solution for the independent comics publisher. If you want to read some comics, check out Indie Planet Digital, where you can download thousands of comics to your favorite digital reading device, IndiePlanetDigital.com. This time on the show, you have to be optimistic if you work in publishing, you don't want to be nasty, and let's celebrate the freedom to be ugly. All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show, recorded live, usually at the Ann Arbor District Library, but every once in a while, I am compelled to record them from home for these unscheduled episodes. These are usually on Wednesdays, this one's on a Tuesday. This is the show where we talk about making comics, writing comics, drawing comics, the lifestyle of the cartoonist, all the stuff that surrounds this medium that drives us all mad. My name is Jersey Droz, cartoonist and teaching artist. With me today is Eric Orchard, who's been on the show a couple times before, Eric, episode 57 and 87. So it's been a while since we got to talk together.
It has, yeah. I usually get in around Halloween, and I'm always so happy to be here. Thanks so much, Jersey. Hi, folks.
Eric Orchard, Inky Bat on Twitter, and what's your main website right now?
Just www.ericorchard.com.
EricOrchard.com. And a new book just came out recently, Maddie Kettle and the Adventures of the Thimble Witch, yes. Right?
Very excited.
Which I should pull that up so we can actually see some of the art from this. Whoops. I had my overlay on the whole time. Let me do this. There we go. So we've got Maddie Kettle, which is the story of a young girl whose parents have been turned into kangaroo rats. And she says, this won't do. And so she goes, and she has a magic toad that is abducted by evil goblin-like creatures. And she goes off in quest to get her magic toad back and restore her parents to humanity. Mm-hmm. And this is from Top Shelf Productions. Mm-hmm. So we've talked with you before. I mean, I've had you on the show before to talk about, scary stories, horror stories. You were on with John David Guerra of NightmareProWrestling.com. And people should go back and listen. We had some really great discussions on the topic on episode 57 and 87. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk specifically about your work this time because you got the new book out that people mm-hmm. should go out and read. And B is that as I was reading the book, mm-hmm. I came up with this summary, is that it's as if Edward Gorey and Marie Sendak got together and retold The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I don't think I could do better than that. I think that's perfect. That makes my day, actually.
Great. That's the vibe I got from it. As I was reading it, it really took me back to that time when I was a little kid and I first discovered where the wild things are, and I thought, this is a little bit scary, mm-hmm. but I am intrigued. And I feel like these monsters, although they visually arrest me a little bit, I feel like they could be friends, right?
Yeah.
And that's what's going throughout this whole book is this sense of, and we're going to get to this, I think, in like the third part of the show, is this sense, like there's this weird kind of eeriness to the art, but there's a sweetness to the story in that it's ultimately a very optimistic book, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. despite the initial appearances of all of these different creatures and goblins and witches and bats and things. But so as I was trying to like pick it apart, I was like what is it that Eric's doing that's making me say creepy? Because when I look at, and I'll pull back up the two, Harry and Silvio. Yeah, two of the characters who assist Maddie on her quest. Is that up on the screen now? Let me see if I can get it. So we've got like this raccoon and this bear, and the raccoon's playing the banjo, and the bear's trying to fix a deflated balloon, and they're having some back and forth on it. And they're cute. They're cute characters. Hmm. But the raccoon has this vacant look about him. He doesn't emote, right? The bear kind of emotes a little bit, but the raccoon, Silvio, does not emote at all in any of the pages of the book.
Yeah.
And you've got like this kind of almost a woodcut kind of line style that you use for like texturing everything.
Yeah.
So, So you got these highly textured yet subdued illustrations, very few ham-handed expressions in the story, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then again, like you got characters like Silvio, which is these vacant white eyes, yet yeah. he clearly has a personality through the dialogue and through his actions.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to crown off my point with...
Oh, yeah.
This whole book has a quiet eeriness that belies an optimistic story. And I'm wondering if this was... Here's where I'm going to ask you one of those squishy, dumb artist questions, Eric. That's
okay. Yeah, I'm ready for it.
Is that intentional, or is that just like an inflection of who you are as a person?
I think it's a reflection of my worldview. I tend to see in the world a lot of those sort of... that contrast between, you know, things are cozy and safe, but there's always a threat, or there's always something strange about everything. And it's this sort of wonderful, weird tension and contrast in the world that I'm always striving to recreate. And I don't know if it has any, I'm an optimistic person, and I think that's where the optimism comes from. I'm just, you know, it's you have to be optimistic to a certain degree to work in publishing. But I think the
I'm sorry, that's a quote that I gotta pull.
It's a thing, man. anyone you meet in publishing is an optimist, whether they disagree or not. So it's you know, I sort of I've had that feeling in me since I was little, like that feeling of tension between the sweetness and something creepy. And it's something that just comes out in my work naturally, in everything I do, really, you know. Yeah.
So, but this is a drum I've beaten on a lot on the Comics Great yeah. Show and other shows that I do, is that as I was reading it, I was hit by this thing about how comics, like Maddie Kettle, could not be done as effectively as a TV show or a movie. Now, let's hope that happens. Let's hope it does get made into a movie, because then you get big, fat checks.
Right? Right.
But I don't feel like it would be very difficult to make it, to achieve that tone that you've achieved, by virtue of the fact that a lot of the tone is achieved through line.
Yeah.
And color choice. And, yeah. and the understated body language of the characters. And a lot of the things that you're asking the reader to infer is, like, when I look at this raccoon, I look at Silvio and I see those vacant eyes and the, you know, this kind of deadpan expression and not much body language, yet mm-hmm. I have to read what he's saying to infer that, no, he's actually a pretty sweet, helpful guy, because when Maddie yeah. says, like, can you help me? He's like, sure, why not? You know, yeah. there's no like threshold to cross there. It's just like she asks for help and he gives it.
Yeah.
So, but because that you've got like these, I should pull up some more of these pages to, as I talk about this, some of these like dark and creepy feelings that you get from the art just simply couldn't yeah. be done in film, right?
I think that comes from folklore as well. Because when you look at folklore or works that are influenced by folklore, you have these characters that are helpful. But at the same time, they have this element to them where there's a threat implied, or maybe not a threat, but some sort of darkness. Miyazaki is a good example. If you look at Totoro, when you first see Totoro, and in other sequences, you know, and Miyazaki talks about this. He's not a good guy in the traditional sense, where he's like just this happy, fluffy, good character. There's a implicit sense of strangeness. I think that's what I'm trying to express. There's an explicit sense of strangeness in folkloric characters, and it runs through Japanese, Russian, English, French folklore. It's always there, and you know, you have the hero going through, and they're dealing with this world that has this sense of strangeness in it that they're navigating, and I think that relates directly to how children navigate the real world. Everything has a sense of strangeness to it. And maybe that's why, you know, kids are drawn to dark things sometimes. They relate to navigating the world, and adults are weird and sometimes scary. And they need that, you know, they crave that element in their art as well.
I think of, yeah, Miyazaki's a good example. And when I think of when I saw Spirited Away in the theater, gosh, this would have, when did that come out? 2002, 2003, yeah, yeah. Somewhere in the neighborhood. And I remember the scene with No Face in the bathhouse. Mm. You know,
such ambiguity.
Yeah. I mean, like, at first there's the ambiguity of, like, he's trying to give gold to people and he's just making that weird noise and it's kind of creepy and a little bit off. Mm-hmm. But then he goes crazy and there's that big scene with the chase through the bathhouse and everything. And I remember sitting in the audience. And I was a little bit younger then, and yeah. I remember thinking, like, is this a kid's movie or not?
Yeah.
But then upon reflection, that stuck with me because it was so, again, arresting and kind of, I don't want to say shocking, but it was arresting to see that scene. I thought about it a lot afterwards, and I was like, well, actually, now that I think about it, a lot of the children's literature I grew up on, you know, when you think of, like, Alice in Wonderland and you think of the original Wizard of Oz books with those illustrations, like, a lot of stuff looked really kind of creepy, and I remember being captivated by it as a child. I wasn't terrified of it as a child, right? As a matter of fact, I think it creeps me out more as an adult than it did as a child, in a way,
I think of John Neal's illustrations of what's that character in Oz with the horse that's like he's a workhorse, sawdust horse. Oh,
the sawhorse.
The sawhorse. That. Thank you. Like, I found him terrifying as a child because you had this, like, intelligence put into just a few pieces of wood. And there was just something so sad and creepy about it. And at the same time, so magical. And it just inspires awe and fear at the same time. In me, anyway. That's always been my response. And it still is. And that's what I look for in the stuff I read as well. So, you know.
I think of the Patchwork Girl, too, was another character who, like, you know, visually, she was really just off and almost nightmarish. But she was this cheerful, like, kind of not quite in our reality, not quite aware of what was going on around her kind of character. And just visually so, like, almost like, well, she was a patchwork girl. She was, like, patched together dolls, and she had, like, this kind of clown-like look to her, which was also really kind of eerie enough. But I like this idea of, you know, because, like, the title of this one, as I was, you know, tweeting it out and saying, like, hey, show up to the show. We're going to talk about the blending of cute and eerie. Mm-hmm. Is that in modern times, not everybody. I mean, you got guys like Tim Burton who understand this very, very well.
Yeah.
You got, like, even Paul Rubens, like I think of, like, Pee Wee's Playhouse and Pee Wee's Big Adventure is, like, an excellent example of something that blends, like, something that's a little off and a little creepy in this really compelling way that's totally accessible to children and, like, thrilling to children, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you get segments of the general population who think still this idea persists that Disney's Magical Kingdom is and that's even too broad a generalization because, like, they think of this very narrow, like, Mickey Mouse kind of thing. It's like, that's what children's entertainment is, because if you really look at Disney's like wide breadth of stuff, there's a lot of darkness in there.
I've actually been turned away by art agencies because my work was too creepy. Or I've had other art agencies ask me to change my work to make it more on the sweet side and to tone back some of the strangeness. So I've had issues with that. There's issues, and it's you know, some of the themes I want to talk about. I've come into conflict with editors about it as well. Moral ambiguity is something that publishers have issues with. In characters, like, for kids books, and you know, they want everything clean cut, they want everything bright. Not everyone, of course, you know, obviously.
I want to make it clear that I'm not, like, generalizing all American adults or North American adults who read, you know, or want their kids to read comics or watch cartoons,
exactly,
but there is a stereotype that persists that like, if it's for kids,
yep,
it has to be bright, and it has to, ambiguity is not a good thing, right? It needs to be very, very clear.
Yeah.
And I say this as a guy who loves the unambiguous stuff where the characters turn to the camera and say, remember, don't do this. I find that stuff immensely charming.
Yeah, and for sure.
And what's funny is I was reading your stuff, I'm like, wow, Eric's, like, on the polar opposite spectrum of where I like to write, because I like to write the characters who are really ham-fisted, like, loud, bold, colorful, and very unambiguous, right? And there's the selfish guy.
Of course.
I think
it comes down to what do children want, and some kids are going to go into the library and pick the most colorful, you know, fun, silly stuff they can, or they'll pick the most darkest, fun, silly stuff they get. You know, it's really you know, I can really, I have such vivid memories of the library, both the school library and the public library as a kid, like, you know, grade school and middle school. And I can just, I have such vivid memories of looking for that dark stuff and wanting to, and that morally ambiguous stuff and relating to it so much. I was actually trying to remember names of some of the books before the show started, but I didn't have any luck, and the hive mind wasn't any help either. So it's there were a number of books I just loved as a kid, and it was that sort of dark stuff I went for. And although, you know, there is some darkness in Disney too, I have to say, like,
sure,
stuff is the Pixar stuff kind of does that balance sometimes. As, you know, especially like Toy Story. Toy Story 3 was kind of shocking to me. I was surprised they went to some of the places they did.
Toy Story 3, I can never, ever watch again because the ending was so emotionally taxing.
I can't watch it with my son because I cry like a baby.
Yeah, I mean, like quivering. Like, yeah. I was actually like doing the yeah. kind of thing while I was watching.
Awful, ugly heaving cries. And it's like, no, I can't watch this with people.
Did you say ugly heaving cries?
Yeah.
That was exactly it. That was exactly, yeah. I mean, and it was the part in the furnace where yes. they're sliding to the fire and brutal. Jesse grabs Woody's hand and there's this little thing they do. And I tweeted about it. I remember tweeting, dear Pixar animators, whoever did, mm-hmm. you know, that twitch in just eye, you know, it's like you've devastated me.
Oh, it's genius, you know. And then Pixar can also do something like Cars, which is just plain old fun. There's no subtext, nothing. You know, it's a little, but a lot of the Disney stuff really bright, really fun. But it's also intelligent. I don't think, you know, I think that the core thing when dealing with kids is just to not talk down to them and let them choose what they want. I don't want to go on about it because I'll end up saying something I don't mean, because it's sort of like I'm working it out in my head as I talk. But it's the obvious end point I have is that kids should always be allowed to read what they want, and I feel that really strongly. So, yeah.
Well, and you say this like right on the cusp of Banned Books Week too, right?
Oh, right, yeah.
That's good timing. No, I mean, but I've got a counterpoint. I've got a devil's advocate point to make here, Eric, is we are dealing with a visual medium.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with something that shows and not tells.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And the perennial example I always point to is when I was working on a book with somebody and it was meant for kids, and the topic came up of there was an important part of the story where a dog was supposed to bite a young character.
Mm-hmm.
In the story. Mm-hmm. How do we navigate this? Like, how can we deal with this in a comic so that it's not too much, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer I came up with at the time was, well, if we don't see teeth penetrating skin, you mm-hmm. know, it's kids know that dog bites happen, and kids conceptually know that injuries happen. That's not above their radar, and it would be a disservice to them if we pretended that our characters lived in a world where danger doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But we can't show the actual teeth penetrating the skin and the horror of the gore. Right, mm-hmm. because it's a visual medium, so we got to show it in some other way. We got to make it happen off panel or hear it somehow or something. So question: is this something that you intuit as you're working, or do you have any kind of internal rubric that you use for how do you navigate when? What's the difference between too far?
Because
a lot of pages in the comic, you'll shroud some of the bad guys in shadow to make them even more mysterious rather than showing like, oh, here's the horrific bad guy, right?
Well, that's like
example
like,
why you talk about it.
You know, I'm going by that rule that one in the first Alien movie where, you know, you don't see the alien until the end and it just makes it scarier. And I think that's for that, but that's what you're talking about. There was actually a scene cut from Maddie Kettle because myself and the editor felt it was too scary. And it's a part where Maddie thinks her parents are dead and she's holding the limp bodies in her hand. And it was just, it was, I think, too much. And it might have been it's intuitive. And for me, you know, you just don't want to be nasty because like, if I had done that scene, I would have been wondering if I was doing it just to get a response. And you don't want to start doing easy emotional targets. You don't want to get sentimental with this stuff, you know? You want to, there has to be a reason for it. in the story, an emotional truth to it. And so if you're putting something in that's just kind of mean and nasty for the sake of it, there's no emotional truth there. It just sort of, to me, and that's what I'm kind of going by. But I think, and it also depends on your style. Like if I would look at a Quentin Blake book, and if he had like decapitations in there, it wouldn't bother me because it's so ridiculous and it's so silly. But if someone like, you know, Chris Van Elsberg had decapitations, it would be extremely upsetting. So I think a lot of it depends on context and style, and that's a really big thing.
I wonder if you could elaborate on this distinction between being nasty and emotional truth and just trying to get a response. What do you mean by, and I'm just asking for your particular opinion on what do you mean by emotional truth in the work?
Let me see. It's sort of like, when you're telling a story, it has to be true to the characters and the world. And you sort of feel it. You feel like you're leaving, you're telling someone else's story, you know, like you're the characters, it has to feel real.
You're telling somebody else's story. That's an interesting spin on it. So yeah. Like if I'm telling a story about something that happened to somebody else, I'm not editorializing on them. I'm relaying their incidents. And maybe I'm composing it in a way to make it interesting, but I'm not ascribing my particular worldview through it. Yeah, is that what you're saying? Yeah.
That, and I also mean you don't want to, you know, be writing to people's expectations too much. Like when you start to write and you're worried how people will feel about something, that's the stuff you edit out later if you don't like it. But yeah, this is something that it just comes up as it's going, and I can't put it to words too well because it's sort of like it's part of the writing process that is so mysterious to me. And I don't know, I've got that line that you don't cross, and that it shifts depending on the story.
Does that line shift within a story for you?
Yeah, I think so, within the context of what's going on. You know, like I feel like you can push things like you can have some things that are really quite scary in some parts, but other parts, it's you do have to deal with that sort of the way children think. And if it feels unjustified, like children need to feel, you know, and I want this too in books. I need to feel that something is justified, and if something awful happens to someone and then it doesn't make sense within that context, it's really disappointing in a book. Like you just feel let down, and that's my feeling. That makes sense.
Narratives, we go to narratives, I think, for entertainment, for information, but also for escape.
Yeah, yeah.
And when we go to escape something, like I've heard lots of writers talk about this, like the story has to have like an internal logic of its own, and it can be logical as long as it resolves in its own logic in some way. And what I think that speaks to is our desire for meaning
of
things. Bad things happen. Right. And nobody wants to be, well, few people, good people don't want to be that guy or gal who looks at a kid and says, you know what, you might get hit by a truck tomorrow.
Yeah.
City Hall, life's a big nasty dog that's going to chew you up and spit you out and deal with it, kid.
Yeah.
As children, and I think as adults, we want there to be some kind of something meaningful about the behavior. And then this is where we get to things like Chekhov's gun, right? It's like, don't put the gun on the wall if you're not going to use it in Act 3. Because otherwise the audience is going to be going, why was that there? Why did he do that? Why did he put that there?
Yeah.
Unless you're creating like a Dadaist story, people, audiences, I think, crave meaning out of everything that happens in it. And if they can't find it, they get confused and a little bit taken out of the narrative, right?
Yeah. It's you know, I've thought a lot about this stuff, and it's really hard to sort of pinpoint, because it's so fluid. And sometimes I like stories that, you know, like something like Adventure Time, it has, the storytelling is amazing in that. And some, you can enjoy it as these little fragments, and it doesn't have to have like this, you know, it can be about the search for meaning. And it's, I love that. It's a children's series, and, you know, it can talk about a search for meaning and prepare children for that, because that, you know, eventually they're going to have to search for meaning themselves, and I think that's okay. So that's, you know, so you get that sort of thing too. I think what I mean when I talk about that, you know, sometimes there can be a surface nastiness in kids' books, like the mean parent or the mean teacher, and they're just like this stereotype from kids' books, and it doesn't really have a lot of, you know, narrative like meaning. It's just sort of like, oh, here's the mean teacher, and they're awful to the student, and it's you know, sorry, my parrot's driving me nuts, and it's sort of it just doesn't work for me, and it feels obvious, you know. You can
right, like, hey, kids, you hate adults and authority, right?
Exactly.
Kids are smart. Adults are dumb, after all. And I'm here to tell you, as the author, I'm on your side.
Yeah. It's cheap. And it feels like things are so much more nuanced for that than not for kids. that's my sense of it anyway.
And when I was kind of driving at this whole idea about meaning, I wasn't trying to suggest that all stories need to, as Dave Roman likes to say, put a lampshade on the punchline or the meaningful moment to say, see, folks, it's about this.
Yeah.
But having a sense of closure to an idea, or having a sense of this action led to another action that resolves a thing, even if it's to make a point about this is not about finding meaning, but it leads to the point about the search for meaning, right? Yeah.
Yes.
But to have some central point to it without it being, like you were suggesting earlier, like pandering to an audience. Playing to an assumption about the audience that isn't necessarily well thought out. Like,
yeah,
for instance, all children want to rebel against adults, and that's not true. As somebody, as a father, I'm sure that you know this is not to be true. And as a teacher, somebody who teaches children, they want to please me. They want to make me happy in the classroom, you know?
Yeah.
So
Yeah, kids are, it's funny. And my son is now in grade one, and he has his first really strict teacher, and he loves her, you know? And it's just sort of like he didn't like the teachers who were too easy on him. So there's sort of they're complicated creatures, like kids. And there's no use guessing or assuming what they want. You just have to do the best you can, you know, like, and treat them as complicated creatures who, like us, like grown-ups, you know.
Another. This is borderline stereotype, but I'm guessing it comes from some kind of common experiences. That as a father, did you have to go through the period where, and I don't know when this happens in childhood, but the whole why because it's green, why because it's got chlorophyll, why because
it evolved. Yeah, I got that, and it drives me nuts.
But I think that's something that points to, like, what their worldview is they just want to know what's the logical path that leads to this thing that they're observing, right?
Yeah. It's like that wonderful quote by Chesterton. And I can't remember what it is precisely, but the gist of it is, to a child, everything is magical. A door opening is magical because they don't know what's behind it. And there's this constant sense of wonder and fear and bafflement all the time. And, I think that's a big theme in a lot of the best kids' books, you know, and also even in picture books. And it's something that you can strive for.
I want to get at, like, you know, we've been talking about how you intuit and how the style that you use is just an inflection of your worldview.
Yeah.
But part of the listenership and viewership of the show is people who are maybe just starting out doing this kind of stuff, and they don't know they don't know what to expect from the path, right? Yeah. And yes, every path is different, but the reason that I even started the show in the first place was to talk with other creators, cartoonists, authors, yeah, etc., to collect as many different paths as possible so that people, yeah, can get at least like some way stations, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was digging through your Tumblr, the BatOrchard2.
Yes.
Tumblr.com.
Yeah. Inspirations and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and when I was looking through this, I was like, wow, Eric is cataloging everything that thrills him, and you get this kind of like visual catalog of here's what makes up the Eric Orchard style.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true.
And yeah, as I'm looking through it, I'm like, okay, I'm seeing a lot of images of, you know, like atmospheric, borderline, yeah, creepy, yeah, dark imagery. And then I'll see an animal and people close.
Yeah. I know. It's good to have variety. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, like it oscillates between these two things. Like I'm looking at it right now. Like, so like I just saw, okay, here's like this Grim Reaper going through the woods and this beautiful textured, almost, yeah, woodcut looking nature scene. Yeah. And then the next image is this wonderful, like 1950s kind of postmodern cartoon, yeah, Fox playing the violin and singing.
Yeah. And I'm somewhere in there.
So does this, do you collecting these things? I mean, first of all, I mean, you post on this thing pretty darn regularly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my first question is like, how are you curating all this information?
Intuition.
No, I mean like what ways are you, I mean, what feeds are you using to get
a
these?
A lot of fine art tumblers. Like I, you know, I have a fine art degree, an art history degree, and I've always loved collecting images. I used to buy secondhand art books before the internet and cut out the pictures, and my wall was covered in art, illustration and art, you know, from Middle Ages art right through to modernist art. Like I've always just been, I consume it. Like I just love looking at art. And so I, you know, and I remember when the internet first started, and you could print stuff off from the internet for the first time. And I was printing off these really awful, you know, inkjet or, you know, pictures of Arthur Rackham and stuff. These images I'd never seen before. I was so excited. And so I think I still have that excitement about that. It's like constant discovery. So I look for illustration blogs and nature blogs and just all over the place.
So this is something where you're actively, both actively and passively searching. So you subscribe, yeah, to feed.
More passive. Like if I need a break from work, I'll sit aside with my phone or my iPad, and I'll flip through and share stuff and write down names. It's also a way to write down names too if I don't have a, you know, pen on me. Well, I always have a pen on me, but if I, you know, if I'm feeling lazy, it's there for me to go back and look at, but new stuff that I've discovered, but also a way to share stuff I've always loved. Like a lot of our people don't know John Bauer, the Swedish artist, or certain books of ours from the Middle Ages, and so it's just nice to be able to share that stuff. The Provincians, the mid-century illustrators are two of my, you know, favorite illustrators. And, you know, there's no book about them. And, you know, how do people find them? They find them by mistake. Or, you know, they get the color caps for their kids. And you know, so it's you want to share. There's a real urge to make sure people know what the good stuff is, you know.
Okay, but, you know, let's go to the selfish question.
Yeah.
How does this affect the work that you do? Has this had any kind of, like, does collecting and curating this ongoing inspiration Tumblr, does that affect your, you know, the specific things you bring to the work? And that's the first part. And then the second part is, how does that affect your workflow, your flow state, right? Because, like, you're working all day. It's going to be highs and lows.
Yeah.
Periods where you don't feel like doing it anymore, and there's going to be periods where you're on fire. So yeah. First part is, how does it directly affect the actual images that you choose in the work? And secondly, how does that affect the workflow?
Well, I let in a lot of influence. Like I try to leave myself very open to bringing stuff in, you know, both fine art, illustration and comic book work. So I am, it explicitly affects my work and pushes me further to be better. And I'm always, I try to look at the best stuff and I try to strive for that. And in fine art and it in illustration and in comics. So I'm always striving just to do the most visually arresting and stuff that is most effective and getting the feel and the sensibilities I want to cross. So
do you know what it is that's arresting you in the image, or is it more of like I just like a reactional, like that's cool, I am not gonna spend time dissecting it, I'm just going to grab it, capture it and come back to it later, or is it something where it's like I'm looking at right now, and I'll pull this up on your Tumblr, you've got Das Kolosseum in einer Mondnacht, the Colosseum on a moonlit night by Carl Gustav Karas, and I'm looking at this, I'm like, what a composition. What a great position. It's got awesome depth. It's got awesome color. It's got awesome texture. Are you thinking about it that way, or is it just more like oh, that's got something?
I think it's more like, oh, that's got something. It's just and I will steal compositions. Like I don't sit there and redraw stuff necessarily, but it gets filed away in my head, and I'm, you know, I will reuse. Or explore things that I see in my comics and books, for sure.
Mm. Okay, well then, how does it affect the workflow?
During the day? Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know. Like, I work long hours, so I find I'm pretty restless. I'm a restless person, so I actually find it almost helps to have sort of an outlet to sort of get away from stuff. And just get absorbed in looking at art and thinking about art, and so it's something I need in a sense. So I don't think about it as an interruption. I think of it as a necessity, and you know, and I have like, if you ever, you know, you're always welcome to come over to my place for dinner, where you can join our family. But then I show you my bookcases, and I have essentially the same thing as my Tumblr in the house. Every room has books in it, and it's very much the same. I'm always flipping through. I'm always, you know, looking for something new, and I need that. I need that feed to be going on.
So it centers you.
It does, yeah. It really does.
I talk about this a lot with fellow cartoonists, and like whenever I hear a buddy getting into a rut with their work, or they're feeling a little disenchanted or like disheartened about the work itself, I say, like, when was the last time you centered yourself? And they're like, well, you know, like, well, what do you mean centering? Like, surrounding yourself with the thing that reinforces or supports your worldview, not to become myopic.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like I'm going to be like, well, I'm a Republican, so I'm just going to put a bunch of pictures of Ronald Reagan around me, and then there we go. Or here, Margaret Thatcher, she makes me feel at ease because she reminds me of this, right?
Yeah. It's about going back to the origins of what you love and what brought you to it. And you need that reminder sometimes. You know, even though what you love changes, you're still gonna, the heart of it is always going to be there, you know?
Yeah, that's really good. Do you remember when you identified what the heart of it was? Because I remember it was a very specific moment for me where I wrote a line in a sketchbook. I wrote a memo to myself about how to address a story. And that was the moment where I was like, oh, that's the kind of stories that I like to do. I just wrote it out and I didn't realize I was writing it out. But was it a clear cut thing for you where it kind of crystallized, or was it something that like over time it's sort of like a cloud kind of coalesced?
I think over time. I think it's just sort of developed. You know, like a lot of ideas, it's just stuff has just sat around and coalesced into something sort of cohesive for me. And I can't, because, you know, it's looking back, I can sort of see how I was building up all these things I love and having them around. And then now I'm like, oh, yeah, now I see where it was coming from. But I didn't, you know, there was no... You know, and it's funny because I'm like you, I write down these things. I don't keep journals, but I keep notes, and I keep my thoughts written down about art and about storytelling and being attacked. And
Albert Pineapple wants in on the discussion.
Does, yeah. I'm just kidding. here he is. Whoa.
People should follow you on Tumblr and Instagram to see more of Albert Pineapple's adventures.
Yeah, I started a Vine too, which is almost exclusively the parrot. But Yeah, so I guess, you know, it's funny because I can remember the point where I finally felt satisfied with my art. I was 26.
Yeah, it was about the, it took about that long for me,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. And I felt like, oh, this is it. I figured it out. Like, what, like, it's like I passed some hurdle. And I can't even put into words what it was. It was just like I finally stopped loathing my work.
Okay, well let's take age out of it and let's put it more into perspective. Yeah. How many years? Right. Well, how many years was it when you were 26? Like that, where you were seriously pursuing it before you looked at it and was like, "Hey, the kid's got something."
I don't know. I started keeping sketchbooks at 13, so I don't. And I did what I think of as really good work at 13 and 14. Like it's surprising me how good it was, but then I did a lot of horrible stuff too. Like, and it was sort of like, I felt like every, you know, one out of every 20 pieces was any good. And then I got to that point where over 10, 15 years, I got to that point where I had the confidence that I knew every piece had a good chance of surviving, you know, of being something worthwhile. And because, you know, I'm well past the stage where I throw out sketchbook pages, which I used to do all the time. And now it's like, no, it's okay. You know, I think it's also just living with your style and living, because it's so personal, right? And it takes a while just to get that sense of comfort with, you know, it's like a mirror. You know, it's like looking at your art is looking in the mirror all the time. And it can really, if you look in the mirror too much, it can really distort what's there. And you really need to get a certain level of objectivity and comfort with looking at that stuff.
Yeah, I think about like when I see like the sketchbook project or artists who post their sketchbooks online, and I see this happening with my younger students. Yeah. And I don't want to say younger. I just want to say beginning students, right? Because I also teach older kids and adults, and I see them being dismayed by, wow, their sketchbook looks like a work of art in and of itself, and my sketchbook doesn't look like that. Therefore, you know, it's like, oh, I got the page two of my sketchbook and this drawing is crap. Well, the sketchbook's ruined now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, it's only ruined if you stop drawing and you need to fill it.
Yeah.
Fill it and then fill another one, then fill another one. And you'll see that upon reflection, these things are starting to look, you know, are looking pretty good, right?
Yeah. I can remember the moment in high school when someone looked at my sketchbook and said, oh, I know someone who keeps a sketchbook and every piece is this finished piece. And it broke my heart, you know? And then I realized if I did my sketchbooks like that, I would do no finished work. Like,
yeah,
I need to pour that into, you know, and then you need that. You need to develop that fast gestural style. Everyone needs that style, that messy style. They need the freedom to be ugly in their sketchbooks. And if you don't have that freedom, you're missing out on some important stuff, you know?
I'm grabbing that one too. That's going in the tease. The freedom to be ugly. No, but I mean, I have you know, a lot of loose gestural stuff that goes into my sketchbooks in the early planning phases of my books, where I'm writing visually, right? Like I'm visualizing the scenes, and maybe I don't even know what they're saying yet, but I know essentially what the body language and behaviors are going to be. And my wife has reported on several occasions, she'll look at like the initial loose, messy, ugly sketches, and she'll say, what happens between that and your final to where you lose like 30% of your energy?
Yeah, it's not crazy.
Yeah, it's like the ugly stuff is so fluid, and yet when you clean it up, it tightens up. And I mean, there are lots of artists that talk about this, like every step you add to the process takes away like 10% of the energy or fluidity of the thing. But
yeah.
And what that pointed me at is that there's a beauty in the ugly, messy drawings that we can't overlook as well, right?
I know there is, absolutely. And then there's no way to retain that easily. It's a funny thing. So, I just
like the idea that in a different context, these ugly sketches have their own intrinsic beauty and value that you lose when you get to the quote unquote fancy drawings.
Yeah. I think that's fine and natural. And I think it's really, cause I'm a big believer in redrawing. I like to redraw things and get them right and you know, feel really confident. So you got to be okay with losing some of that energy and you know, that fun quality early on. Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to respect your time because I know you gotta go pretty soon here. But I wanted to get to. So we talked about like the navigating creepiness and creepiness is such an unfortunate word. Eeriness. As I was thinking about, I was doing word association with myself. Yeah. Like, what am I thinking of when I look at Eric's work? And I thought, I wrote the word eerie, and then I wrote maybe I'm thinking mysterious. Right, the stuff.
Yeah.
It's very mysterious kinds of drawings and shots,
mm-hmm.
which mystery is unsettling, right? And yet, the dichotomy that you drew in this that I think is so terrific and so interesting to explore is the whole book has themes of optimism, positivity. I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but you find out that things that that are set up with assumptions at the beginning of, wow, this character is this kind of creature, therefore they're bad and we have to stop them.
Yeah.
And then you meet that creature and that creature says, don't hurt me.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that there's not a single person in the book who is either pure good or pure evil. Everybody is ambiguous.
Yeah.
And Maddie's strength as a character in the story is that her first instinct, and this is where I compare her a lot, like in terms of like character archetype, to Ben Hackey's Zeta the Space Girl, because her first initial instinct in any encounter is, can I help?
I have a lot. I think I have a lot in common with Ben with worldview. Ben Hackey, we're both optimistic people. You have to be when you have like multiple kids and work in comics, right? So I really identify with Ben's books as well. I find there's something in there that is really something that sort of gets to my heart as well. And with Zeta, especially, I find that she's someone who kind of, you know, it's the kind of character I want my sons reading about, you know, because she's someone you can kind of strive to be like. That sense of curiosity as well as... it's just a good heart, and that's, you know, I think, you know, that's what I strive to be like as well. So it's something that's good to put in there.
Well, yeah, what I got out of it is that there's an implicit lesson, not explicit. It's a very implicit lesson throughout the story of there's a world of scary things out there.
Yeah,
person, and they look scary.
Yeah,
if you approach them in the spirit of friendship.
Yeah.
Often, it will go better for you.
Yes. Yeah.
Not always, but often.
Yeah. If you go in with an open heart, things will never. You sort of open up reality a bit more. It's you realize the depths of reality are a little bit different than maybe you had conceived them to be. So it's a perceived them to be. So it's you're really getting to the heart of the story there, because there's a lot of that sort of thing in there, which is funny because that wasn't intentional. Like, I wasn't writing that consciously. That just, you know, and it's when you talk about these things, you almost expect me to be like sort of a Buddhist monk with, you know, contemplating these ideas of good and evil and moral ambiguity and stuff. And I'm not like that at all. And it surprised me to have it in there. Because I think I was discovering something in myself that, I really didn't know was there, and I was glad to find it there. But it was a nice surprise.
Something that Dan Mishkin has said to me repeatedly, and on my shows, is that he doesn't like to start off with looking for meaning in the work. Yeah. He likes to discover it through exploring the work.
Yeah, that's almost the point of it in a way, you know, it's one of the points, obviously.
Yeah. So it's something, again, like that you can set up structures, you can set up character charts and everything, but ultimately it's something where you have to kind of, well, I'm going to borrow your own language, is you have to approach it with an open heart and look to discover something about yourself through the work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I feel quite strongly, like I think... writing Maddie Kettle really gave me that sense of like how you draw and how you write a story like that. And I have to give Chris Steros a lot of credit because he really helped lead me to that. So rather than trying to write something that relied on cliches,
Are you still there, Eric?
On easy outs.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Lost the video just for a second, but I see you again.
I don't remember what I just said. Did you get
that? You were saying that Chris Darrow said he steered you away from relying on cliches and took you to...
Yeah, he allowed me to really explore these themes and these ideas in the story, which was just wonderful.
Well, it's a great book that more people should check out. I'm going to pull up on the screen where people can find it, and it's at Top Shelf Comics. Let's see, what's the address? TopShelfComics.com. And it's called Maddie Kettle, Book 1, Adventure of the Thimble Witch. You can get it in print. You can get it in print and a DRM-free ebook. You can get the DRM-free ebook or through other digital partners. And it's a great book for kids and adults, and adults who love, you know, fantasy fiction.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote it for kids and then grown-ups like me. Like me and you. Kids at heart.
So, Eric, we gotta have you back when you have more time, because I love philosophizing about this stuff with you.
I always enjoy these so much. I always leave with a greater understanding of what I'm doing, which is, a great gift of an interviewer, I think. So that's great.
Oh, thank you. And if you're watching this on the day it aired, on the 16th of September 2014, I got my own self-plug to make. This book, The Warren Commission Report, just came out in stores today. It's in print and digital same day. You can get it through Comixology. You can get it for the Amazon Kindle. You can get it at all finer bookstores everywhere. Buy it at your local independent bookstore. You can search for it on indiebound.org. And it's a book about the Kennedy assassination. It's exploring the various conspiracy theories and the findings of the Warren Commission Report and contextualizing it in what was happening in the 60s and how the world changed that fateful day in November of 1963. So, Dan Mishkin.
I can't wait to read that.
I'm really proud of it, and I hope lots of people read it, but I would be remiss if I didn't make a plug about it on my own platform. So,
for sure. I should be interviewing you about the book.
but people should get that and Maddie Kettle. So thank you, Eric Orchard. Any other sites or things you want to plug before we go?
Oh, no, that's it. Follow me on Twitter. I'm InkyBat. Follow my... My Tumblr is at Bad Orchard and Bad Orchard 2, T-O-O. And, write me an email. I'm always open to talk about my work. And it was great talking to you, Jersey.
All right. So this show will be archived at comicsgreat.com/CAG103. And if you enjoyed the show, you could help it out a lot by giving it a star review on iTunes. You don't even have to write a review, just however many stars you think it deserves. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, give it a thumbs up. That helps more people find the show and more people discover awesome artists like Eric. So until next time, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.